Welcome to America's Providential History Podcast, where we talk about the real story of America and explore the hand of God in our history. Now, here's your host, Stephen McDowell.
Hello, I'm glad you're joining us for this edition of America's Providential History. Now, we are looking for many podcasts exploring the faith of the presidents, or some of the presidents of the United States. And we began with George Washington, our first president. The first couple of podcasts, I looked at Washington's reliance upon God and actions in his life that reveal his Christian character and faith. And then last podcast, I in particular began to examine, was George Washington a Christian? And we saw that different people have different views on this. Those in earlier times, would certainly every one of them would have said it. In later years, people began to promote this idea that, well, he was a deist, most likely, or maybe, as one modern historian said, a lukewarm Episcopalian. But we began to examine the evidence. We don't get that image at all, because as we talked about last podcast, is that his family and friends and pastors, those that knew him well and other acquaintances, testified he's a man of Christian faith, embraces the Christian truths and Christian principles, and he wrote about this in his writings, that he had 80 different references to God. He quotes many different scriptures. He served on the leadership of two churches, which was an elected position. So he had certainly the backing of all those who knew him through his church life, that recognized here was a Orthodox man who will carry out the work of the gospel. And so, if you haven't listened to last week's podcast, I'd encourage you to do so because of the things that I presented then. But I want to continue on this story and look at the evidence. Well, was he a Christian? Now, Washington's knowledge of God came from his parents, from the church, and his own personal studies. Now, he had more than 150 sermons and Christian books in his library at his death. And one of the books in his library was a 24-page handwritten manuscript entitled The Daily Sacrifice. Now, some people have suggested that this work, which contains daily prayers that are very explicitly Christian in their content, was written by Washington when he was a young man. Though we don't really have any direct evidence that he did so, but he certainly knew the importance of Christian education, and the very fact that he had such a book in his library and no doubt read this many times is an indication this was an important work to him. If he wrote it, it certainly is astounding recognition of his understanding of Orthodox faith, but even the fact that he had it and read it in his library is a great demonstration of the faith of Washington. Since he knew the importance of Christian education, not only for himself but others, he gave Bibles and prayer books to Martha's children. Now, Martha was a widow when they were married in 1759. Her first husband died with left them two children. And that her child, John Parke Custis, married and had four children. He died during the American Revolution. And the two youngest of Martha's grandchildren, John Parke Custis's children, they went to live as just very young with the George and Martha Washington. So they were raised in the home of George and Martha Washington, and they adopted them like their children. That was Nellie Custis and George Washington Parke Custis. I mentioned them in the last podcast and gave you a number of quotes from them. And so Washington gave prayer books to Martha's children and sent his grandson and adopted son, that's George Washington Parke Custis, to be taught by ministers at Princeton and St. John's Colleges. Of course, at this time, every college was Christian. Most were founded by a particular denomination, some just Christian faith in general. And when you went to college, you in essence were getting a seminary degree, not just doctrinal belief, but biblical worldview thinking. Washington prayed. He read the Bible. He had personal devotions throughout his life. His nephew, Robert Lewis, was his private secretary during the first part of his presidency, and he lived with Washington for a time. Lewis wrote, he noted, speaking of Washington, he had accidentally, speaking of himself, how he had accidentally witnessed his private devotions. That is, Lewis had witnessed George Washington's private devotions in his library, both morning and evening. That on those occasions, he had seen him in a kneeling posture with the Bible open before him, and that he believed such to have been his daily practice. Now, while Washington was generally reserved in expressing his faith, he didn't neglect public prayers. He prayed for his family, for his nation. Just prior to his stepdaughter, Martha Parke Custis's sudden death at Mount Vernon, this would have been Martha's daughter through her first husband, and she died suddenly at Mount Vernon when she was young. Washington knelt by her and prayed most fervently, most affectionately for her recovery. Now, this is according to Nellie Custis, who was the granddaughter and raised in the Washington home. So she was Patsy's niece, the daughter who died. And so she spoke how Washington knelt by her, prayed most fervently, most affectionately for her recovery, which looks to be a man who knew God and believed God and was responding with someone who he could personally communicate with. Now, in 1783, he wrote a circular to the governors of the states. This was a letter that went to all the governors. In essence, Washington was saying, here's the final advice that I give. If we're going to make it as a nation, there are certain things we need to do. And he concluded that letter with a prayer. He said, I now make it my earnest prayer that God would have you in the state over which you preside in his holy protection. Washington also prayed at meals regularly. The artist James Sharples, who spent time at Mount Vernon painting Washington's portrait, said, I observed that we never partook of food without the general offering grace to the giver. So also at the close of every repast. In other words, he said, and others testified of this, they prayed at the beginning of the meal, and Washington prayed at the end of the meal. Washington also participated in special days of prayer. On June 1, 1774, Virginia observed a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer to show support for the people of Boston. In his diary, Washington recorded, for that day, went to church and fasted all day. And he observed similar days proclaimed by Congress throughout the Revolutionary War. So these public declarations for days of prayer and fasting or prayer and thanksgiving, Washington records observing them, participating in them. So Washington respected and entertained many clergymen and was also close with some of them, including the Reverends Lee Macy, William White, and John Carroll. Ministers and church bodies from all different denominations respected him greatly. Major William Jackson, who was aide-de-camp to Washington, said he was beloved and admired by the holy ministers of religion. So, in other words, he was friends with pastors and knew him, and many testified of his faith. Washington believed in the afterlife, and he wasn't afraid to die. When faced with a severe illness while president, he told his doctor, I'm not afraid to die. I know that I am in the hands of a good providence. About 10 years later, he faced death calmly, saying, I am ready to go. And his last will and testament begins, in the name of God, amen. Now, although Washington was reserved in expressing his faith, one would not know it from his public actions. He carried on his personal devotional life wherever he was, whether at home at Mount Vernon, as President of the United States, or in his field tent during the war. During the French and Indian War, back in the mid-50s, an aide, Colonel B. Temple, testified that on sudden and unexpected visits into Washington's marquee, he has, more than once, found him on his knees at his devotions. So early on, as a young man in his 20s, he was found to carry on private devotions in all kinds of situations. It was said of Washington in a sketch written by an American in London in 1799 that, quote, he regularly attends divine service in his tent every morning and evening and seems very fervent in his prayers. Now, Washington also regularly prayed in public. He prayed in private and he prayed in public. He said grace at public meals where no chaplain was present. An attendant at a state dinner in May 1789 noted, as there was no chaplain present, the president himself said a very short grace as he was sitting down. The chaplain of Congress would dine with him once a month during Washington's presidency, and Washington would ask him to pray at these meals. At one such meal, probably forgetting that Chaplain Ashbel Green was present, the president began to ask a blessing, but after a few words, he bowed to Green and asked him to proceed, which Green noted, I accordingly did. I mention this because it shows that President Washington always asked a blessing himself when a chaplain was not present. Green added that Washington, quote, always, unless a clergyman was present at his own table, asked a blessing in a standing posture. If a clergyman were present, he was requested both to ask a blessing and to return thanks after dinner. So again, testimony that he prayed before and after each meal. Numerous days of prayer were proclaimed by various governmental bodies during Washington's lifetime, and his habit was to observe these days diligently. At times, he would attend public church services, and at times participating with his troops in the field on those public days of prayer and fasting or prayer and thanksgiving. In 1774, he observed such a day by fasting, and he observed many days of prayer during the Revolutionary War. He and Martha, who would come and spend the winter quarters with him wherever he was in the field of battle. He and Martha attended services at the Princeton College Chapel on October 31, 1783, in celebration of the signing of the peace treaty that ended the war. In response to the recommendation of Congress for Americans to observe Thanksgiving services to mark the end of the war, the Washingtons attended church in Philadelphia on December 11, 1783. So many prayers for people, leaders, and the nation can be found in his public writings. And this was especially true during the American Revolutionary War. On July 4th, 1775, just after assuming command of the Continental Army in Massachusetts, he ended his response to an address by the Massachusetts legislature, earnestly imploring the divine being in whose hands are all human events to bring private and public happiness to them. In his farewell orders to the army on November 2nd, 1783, he offered his prayers to the God of armies that ample justice be done them here, and may the choicest of heaven's favors, both here and hereafter, attend those who, under the divine auspices, have secured innumerable blessings for others. And so we see Washington praying. He prays in private. He prays in public. He prays during a very, days of prayer and fasting and prayer and thanksgiving. During both of his administrations, he issued proclamations and observed them. According to the chaplain of the House of Representatives, a man named Ashbel Green, the proclamations which Washington issued for the purpose were probably written by himself. In contrast, for example, to John Adams, who had the chaplains write his proclamations. In October 1789, Washington issued a proclamation for a day of prayer and thanksgiving to be observed on November 26th with the opening words, "Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor." So here it is, at the first of his service as the first president of the United States of America, he's issuing a proclamation for a day of thanksgiving. And in it, it makes a very important declaration. It's the duty of all nations, not just the United States, but he recognized God and His providence as sovereign over all, created all, and all owe allegiance to the Supreme One. So all nations, it's the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of God, and not just to acknowledge His superintending care over His creation. That's what providence means, but to obey His will. So every nation has the duty, according to Washington, to acknowledge God, to obey God, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. I think that's pretty good advice. It's certainly a great understanding of the King, ship of Christ, the Lord, the Almighty One. Now, Washington sought to do this throughout his life, and he also believed the Christian nation of America should do so too, acknowledge God, obey God, be grateful to God. But even more than this, he believed that all nations, as I said, should acknowledge God's providence and obey His will. Imagine a declaration by that today of civil leaders, that every nation, not just America, every nation owes his allegiance, his declaration, his recognition and obedience to God. Washington knew how morality and religion were linked to success in military endeavors, and so he issued orders to procure chaplains for the army during the Revolutionary War. He directed his field commanders, quote, to procure chaplains, persons of good character and exemplary lives, to see that all inferior officers and soldiers attend carefully upon religious exercises. The blessing and protection of heaven are at all times necessary, but especially so in times of public distress and danger. The general hopes and trusts that every officer and man will endeavor so to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier, defending the dearest rights and liberties of his country. So he said, look, we need chaplains. He had them throughout the war. We need God's blessing upon what we do. And not only that, but he said, that Washington said he hoped and trusted every officer and every man will seek to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier. Washington encouraged his troops to seek God and to live like Christians. He many times ordered them to attend worship service and to observe days of prayer and fasting. A few days after Washington took command of the army in Massachusetts, the Reverend William Emerson, who was an army chaplain, wrote that each day's orders were read to the regiments every morning after prayers. So here we have testimony. They prayed every morning, and then the orders were read. On March 6, 1776, Washington ordered the troops to observe a day of fasting, prayer, and humiliation as directed by the state legislature. And he reminded the soldiers at Valley Forge, quote, "To the distinguished character of a patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the most distinguished character of a Christian. So once again, he's saying, you're going to be a good patriot, a good soldier, be a Christian, live like Christ, display his character. He issued orders against profane cursing and swearing, saying that we can have little hopes of the blessings of heaven on our arms if we insult it by our impiety and folly. Added to this, it is a vice so mean and low, without any temptation, that every man of sense and character detests and despises it. That was the first orders he issued when he assumed command. That was one of the orders, forbidding swearing, cursing, profane cursing and swearing. He also issued orders prohibiting gambling and drunkenness. Now, as already mentioned, Washington observed the Sabbath throughout his life. He encouraged his troops to do so as well, and by having the chaplains perform regular Sunday services and not scheduling exercises on Sunday if possible, not drilling them on Sundays if at all possible, and certainly not fighting if at all possible. His general orders of March 22, 1783 state, in justice to the zeal and ability of the chaplains, as well as to his own feelings, the commander-in-chief thinks it a duty to declare the regularity and decorum with which divine service is now performed every Sunday will reflect great credit on the army in general, tend to improve the morals, and at the same time to increase the happiness of the soldiery, and must afford the most pure and rational entertainment for every serious and well-disposed mind. No fatigue except on extra occasions, and our general review or inspections to be permitted on the Sabbath day. So he did all he could to rest on the Sabbath, remember the Sabbath, to honor God, to worship him on the Sabbath, not just for him, but his troops. Now, if no chaplains were present, Washington would at times conduct services himself. Early on, when he was a man in his 20s during the French and Indian War, when Edward Braddock was buried after the Battle of the Monongahela in 1755, he was shot and died not long after that. Washington read the impressive funeral services of the Anglican Church over his body. Because there's no chaplain present, he acted the chaplain. In the years that followed, one of Washington's aides, Colonel B. Temple, observed, frequently on the Sabbath, he has known Colonel Washington to perform divine service with his regiment, reading the scriptures and praying with them when no chaplain could be had. So he understood, look, we got to pray, we got to have a chaplain, we got to observe the Sabbath, we need to be instructed. And of course, that's why he hired chaplains to do that. But if there weren't any chaplains around, he did it. Now, Washington administered the oath of allegiance to his officers in the customary manner, with them standing around him in a circle and together taking hold of a Bible. There you might have seen some prints that depict that particular particular setting. He himself took the oath of office as President of the United States with his hand on the Bible. And Washington also supported the dissemination of Bibles among the troops. So Washington's public writings and letters provide massive evidence in support of his Christian faith, his Christian character, and his Christian worldview. Throughout his life, and especially during the war, he acknowledged the hand of God and the providence of God, writing of needing God's aid and recognizing that success depended upon him. His most significant and widely read writings all reflect a strong declaration of his Christian faith and worldview. That includes his circular letter to the governors, I've mentioned, from June 8, 1783, and his first inaugural address, from April 30, 1789, and his farewell address of 1796. We don't have time to explore these or other of his writings in depth, but in his significant writings that were probably heard and read by more people than others and very influential, all speak of the Christian faith and worldview and evidence of his faith. There was great mutual respect between Washington and the clergy from all denominations. The president's adopted son, George Washington Parke Custis, wrote, "The high respect in which the clergy of the American army was held by Washington was known to every officer and soldier in its ranks." After Washington was elected president, many churches and denominations wrote him letters of congratulations and support, and this correspondence shows his Christian faith. The letters thank him for his support of Christian liberty, thank him for his Christian faith. His replies, according to Jared Sparks, wrote a biography, early biography of him, and compiled his writings. According to Sparks, his replies, quote, breathe a Christian spirit and imply his belief of the truth and authority of the Christian religion. Washington supported Christianizing the Indians for their benefit as well as the nation's. As we've covered in past podcasts, the early states were colonized by people who came to propagate the gospel. And as a new nation, we continue to propagate the gospel in Northwest Territory and later on the Louisiana Territory and others. And Washington understood and agreed with this important command of Christ to disciple the nations. In 1779, he wrote to the chiefs of the Delawares, the Delaware Indians, "You do well to wish to learn our arts and ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are." So he's giving advice to the leader of the Delaware Indians. He said, "The best thing you can do is to learn the religion of Jesus Christ, the Christian faith. These will make you greater and happier people than you are." Now, as president, he wrote to the United Brethren for propagating the gospel among the heathen, saying that it would be a good thing for the government to cooperate with the endeavors of your society to civilize and Christianize the savages of the wilderness. Now, many of the early writings and charters and other things use that term savages. They're speaking of people that have not heard the gospel. They don't know the gospel. They're not civilized. You know, peoples from the beginning of the Christian faith 2,000 years ago, there have been many uncivilized people, and where the gospel has gone and planted its truth in the hearts and minds of individuals, societies, nations, people groups, that's what has produced civility, civilization, giving the ideas of how to love your neighbor and honor God and honor your parents and authority and not steal and all these other moral principles that bring life to men. And so, so Washington, as well as the nation in general, understood we need to propagate this truth, which will liberate and bring civility to those that haven't heard the gospel. It'll change their heart. It'll change their mind. So in summary, Washington was a devoted churchgoer, but he wasn't a sectarian. He didn't write about his doctrinal beliefs, as I mentioned in the last podcast. He didn't have a whole set of here's what I believe and why I believe it. So he didn't, but that's true of so many people, and to write down their own personal doctrinal belief. But his life and writings reflect he embraced Orthodox Christianity. He regularly prayed in public and private, but he really never spoke of his private devotions. His adopted daughter, Nellie Custis, wrote, "He was not one of those who act or pray that they may be seen of men. He communed with his God in secret." And so, since he didn't speak about himself on personal matters, it follows he wouldn't speak about his own religious beliefs either. Although, as we've covered and said, many people saw him in private devotions, humbly and crying out to God. Many, many people testify, secretaries, his family, his officers, and so many people. So he is a man who commits much time in prayer and cries out to God, but he wasn't one to go about writing about it or preaching about it. He said he wasn't a preacher and other things, but he certainly communed with God in secret. And as we've explored in public many times as well, with many public prayers and issued to his troops and so many others. Jared Sparks commented, he wrote a biography of Washington, to say that he was not a Christian, or at least that he did not believe himself to be a Christian, would be to impeach his sincerity and honesty. After studying his life and writings extensively, Sparks, and he compiled many of the writings of Washington, Sparks added, "I have never seen a single hint or expression from which it could be inferred that he had any doubt of the Christian revelation." So, to those who assert that Washington was a deist, they argue that he didn't write of Jesus Christ, but he used vague general terms, so he wasn't a Christian. That's what some people say, as we covered in the last podcast. Some people in more recent times have tried to put forth the idea, Washington wasn't a Christian, he was a deist, and or maybe some kind of nominal Christian, but his faith really wasn't real. So they'll say he couldn't be a Christian because he never wrote of Jesus Christ. He used just vague general language, so he couldn't be. Yet, as I mentioned just earlier, that he wrote to the Delaware chiefs that they should learn the religion of Jesus Christ. He also wrote of the divine author of our blessed religion, certainly speaking of Christ, and called him divine, God himself. But in many of the 80 terms he used for God in his writings expressed the nature of the Christian deity and his son, not some general, generic, deistic view of God. So these also show he had a great knowledge of the nature of God. You know, some people also argue that Washington used deistic terminology, not Christian terminology. For example, they said, well, sometimes he referred to providence as it. But as stated previously, Washington used Christian language throughout his life, including many biblical phrases, and much of his terminology was like that which was used by devout Episcopalians of the time, including devout Episcopalian ministers, because Washington was an Episcopalian. He attended first an Anglican church before the Revolution, but the patriotic Anglicans in America left the Anglican church and formed what became the Episcopal Church, and Washington then would attend the Episcopal Church until the end of his life. And so the language that he would have heard Episcopal ministers used in preaching is similar language that he used. And Washington did use it at times for providence, but since providence is the superintending care of God over his creation, then it is an appropriate way to reference this. But he also used he many times when referring to Almighty God, benign parent, and so on. Jonathan Mitchell Sewell observed, "Let the deist reflect on this and remember that Washington, the savior of his country, did not disdain to acknowledge and adore a greater savior whom deists and infidels affect to slight and despise." So in other words, he's arguing, saying, look, the language of Washington, of how he spoke about God, and he knew the God of the Bible. He knew the Christian Orthodox God and wrote of him in that way, and not some general deistic language or action by any means. Now, another argument used to expound on Washington's supposed deism is the assertion, well, he didn't take communion. Now, while this appears to be true for part of his time as president, and the reason has nothing to do with a lack of Christian belief, don't have time to explore that here, because many other things, many other times, he continued to faithfully attend church. So at times he didn't take communion, but he attended church and went to church, but he did take communion at times, and many people have attested of this, including his granddaughter, Nellie Custis. She wrote that she heard her mother say, "General Washington always received the sacrament with my grandmother before the Revolution." So there were other reasons that Washington at times, at certain churches, did not take communion, but it wasn't because he didn't believe the Christian faith. He didn't believe that this was a sacrament that the church should take. It wasn't because he was an unbeliever and only believers are to take it, or something like this. So if Washington was a deist, then we would expect some ministers of his day to point out this fact or express some doubts of his Christianity. Because certainly they challenged the faith of other prominent founders like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson, but not Washington. And so the arguments put forth by those claiming Washington was a deist are weak. His life, his words, his character, and his action proclaim what his family and friends witnessed to, that he was a sincere Christian believer. Now, as I mentioned earlier, he never wrote of a specific incident when he had a regenerative experience, but many who've raised in a Christian home, as Washington was, and was influenced and surrounded by the church and the Christian faith throughout his whole life, many have not can't point to a specific experience when they might have had a personal encounter with the Lord. But Washington certainly spoke of his faith and demonstrated his faith, and his friends and family testified of his faith. Do we know the heart of George Washington? Well, no, only God knows the heart. God's the one that can judge it, what was going on in the heart of George Washington. But Jesus said, "You'll know them by their fruit." Certainly the fruit of Washington's words and Washington's life, certainly the impact that he had upon this nation, certainly declare, here is a man who embraced the Christian religion. Here's a man who embraced an understanding of the living God and let so many others know about that through how he acted and what he said. And so, was George Washington a Christian? Well, according to the testimony of family and friends, they call him a sincere believer in the Christian faith. How about his heart? Did he have a genuine conversion experience? Well, he didn't speak about that, and so we can't know his heart from that perspective, but we can certainly know all that he did and said in his life. And so in these podcasts, in the last few podcasts, when I've talked about the faith of George Washington, you take that evidence, you take those ideas, and you consider and ponder, and you can make your own decision regarding that. But it's important that you have, all the facts gathered, and we certainly know he was not a deist by any means at all, as some have depicted him, but his faith was alive and living, and I believe the key to his career and accomplishments, being the indispensable man that God certainly raised up and used to give birth to a unique nation, the United States of America. We've been around for 250 years as a united nation, and it was a nation built upon Christian liberty, Christian faith. Christianity was the vital force that united the nation, provided the foundation for the United States to grow and to flourish. And George Washington was key to that. And on the cover of our book, America's Providential History, we have a painting of Washington in prayer at Valley Forge. It was a Scandinavian immigrant from the 70s, Arnold Freeberg, who painted that as a gift to his adopted nation to show his appreciation for this nation and what it meant to him. And it depicts well the reason for America's success. Here it is, the father of our country displays a reliance upon God, crying out to him in many, many ways. We've just, in these recent last few podcasts, just touched on it, really. I've just given you an overview. Now, if you want to get the sources for the quotes and other things that I've covered here, I point you to my book, Apostle of Liberty, The World-Changing Leadership of George Washington. It's a great overview and introduction to the man Washington, highlighting the providence of God in his life and in his words, telling just a brief overview of his life and the character qualities that he displayed, and his faith was the foundation of those. And you can get a copy at our website, providencefoundation.com, and read it for yourselves. But there are many other good books and writings. You can pick up the writings of Washington and get them online and read these yourself, but you got to be prepared because he's over 40 volumes of his writings. So it's going to take you a while to read through them all, but that's why I would start with a book like mine. Nice little introduction to someone that every American, in fact, everybody in the world ought to have some knowledge of this man, the Apostle of Liberty. Well, thanks for joining us. Next week, I think I'm going to talk a little bit more about Washington because people bring up, well, I've heard Washington was a Mason and part of the Freemasonry Church. So how could he be a Christian if he's a Mason? In fact, weren't a lot of our founding fathers Masons? And then how can you say we're founded as a Christian nation if that be the case? And so I think I'm going to take up and look at this idea of the Freemasonry and our founders before we carry on to the faith of some of our other presidents after George Washington. Well, thanks for joining us today, and I hope that you will be back with us next week. God bless you.